From the Center for Investigative Reporting in PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. Recently, President Obama said leaving Libya after the fall of Muammar Gaddafi without a day-after plan was the worst mistake of his presidency. It's been over 4 years since Gaddafi was killed by rebel forces during the Libyan Revolution. But as reported by Channel 4 and the BBC in Great Britain, removing a dictator from power didn't solve Libya's problems.
On a quiet Mediterranean night, you might think all is well in Tripoli, until suddenly it's not.
As you can see, the fight here is street to street and house to house.
The black hole created by Gaddafi's fall has been filled by roving militias and the growing threat of ISIS.
This center holds men accused of fighting for extremist groups. Farage confessed to carrying out dozens of murders and has agreed to talk about the crimes.
They show you how to do it. They do it in front of you, then they ask you to slaughter. So you get the knife and you use it. They stay with you, watching you do it. Yes, it feels strange at first, but after several times, it becomes normal.
Brutal violence is a part of everyday life, and the people who live there somehow have to go about their day-to-day, even kids.
Actually, any country is better than Libya right now.
Aisha Fatai was 14 when Gaddafi fell, and she's been living in Tripoli the whole time. Aside from the fact that she lives in what many would call a war zone, Aisha has a lot in common with most 19-year-olds.
I'm a university student. I'm gonna be a dentist. When I want to have fun, I watch Grey's Anatomy, Friends, The Simpsons.
She remembers vividly what life was like before Gaddafi's regime fell.
Before the revolution, crimes did happen, but there was police. Now, after the revolution, when you get out of your door, you try to listen if there's someone behind the door. And when you get into your car, you immediately lock the doors. There's some neighborhoods that are known for being full of gangs. They just have pistols and guns, and they form like a checkpoint. So they take the car and they run away.
Without police, the only thing people can do is call for help from the dozens of armed groups that keep order. But they operate according to their own rules.
So they start fighting, creating a small clash. Or actually, there's no clash that's small, because every time someone gets killed, there's no place to go. I've been safe so far because it's actually just a matter of luck. We hear about some girl was found killed, some girl was kidnapped today while she was waiting for her brother or father to pick her up.
Aisha tries to float above the chaos around her by living as normal a life as possible. But in a place where the law of the land is non-existent, you just can't float above it all. Sooner or later, you have to come back to the ground. And for Aisha, this hard new reality came in the form of a guy who followed her home from school.
From the moment I step out of the school until I reach my house, he was just harassing me. He wanted to talk to me. He's been telling guys all over the neighborhood that I'm his girlfriend, while I never even know his name. Every day, Sunday to Thursday, when I get out of the school, I find him waiting.
Aisha told her dad.
So dad really freaked out. He had to call his friend. He knows some people in some militia.
Aisha's life ground to a halt. Now her younger brother had to walk her home from school. She couldn't visit friends. She couldn't even go to the supermarket right next door.
I couldn't do any of that anymore in my neighborhood because of this guy. If he did something to me, this militia would come with my dad to rescue me, and this other militia would want to protect their friend, and there might be some clashes between them, and of course, some people might die. But unfortunately, that's how it is.
The militia, friendly with Aisha's father, intimidated the man, and eventually he went away. Aisha has resumed her life, but for how long? Because when there's no authority, everything is up for grabs. Today on Reveal, we're taking you to lawless lands. And while the concept may seem like something that happens far away, you might be surprised to learn that we have our own version of it right here at home. Take the police, for example. In Libya, you can't count on the police to be there in case of an emergency, something you wouldn't think would happen in the U.S.
911.
I just came home and I've been burglarized.
It's December 2015. Cohen Ellenwood is calling 911 for help from his home in rural southwest Oregon.
Okay, the unfortunate thing, sir, is that you're in the county and this has to go through the sheriff's office and they won't be open until tomorrow.
I need help right now, man. I'm telling you what, someone stole everything I owned.
He calls back again and again, sometimes getting transferred to the state police.
Now, what have they told you, sir?
To get lost. Now, can I please have someone come report this?
If they're not going to respond, sir, there is nobody to report it to until 9 o'clock in the morning.
You have no one I can speak to that can be reasonable with me? Picture yourself. Everything you have is stolen.
I understand that.
And you're calling for help, and no one will f***ing come.
Cohen keeps calling a total of 13 times in 1 hour. Finally, someone tells him to come to the police department in Grants Pass, the nearest city, to speak with an officer in person. When he gets there, he's arrested for improper use of 911. This may sound like a really bad joke, but people in Josephine County have come to learn that when they call 911, there's often no one there to help them out. Reveal's Byard Duncan went there to find out why this once sleepy corner of timber country has unraveled into lawlessness.
Yeah, watch your hip when you get in here. I can try and move that over.
On a recent morning, Josephine County Sheriff Dave Daniel jumps into his squad car and heads out on his rounds. Daniel cuts a strong presence, north of 6 feet, linebacker build, salt and pepper crew cut.
1708, clear.
He leaves the sheriff's station and heads into the county's forested folds. It's a beautiful place. Emerald rivers, dollops of cloud slinking between mountains. The area he's supposed to protect is spread out over 1,600 square miles, a little bigger than my home state of Rhode Island. Recently, it's been hard to keep people safe.
Imagine living in an area that you call 911 and no one comes.
Daniel says that's because the sheriff's department budget is about half of what it was 15 years ago. These days, there are often only two deputies covering the entire county.
Seems a bit ridiculous, doesn't it?
There's no detectives division, no major crimes team, and his department patrols just 10 hours a day. Criminals know that, and when the sun goes down, Daniel says it's go time.
Criminals, they're like cockroaches, in a way, because they don't like the light.
Cracking down on crime would mean raising local taxes, but residents have refused to do that for 4 years in a row. That's despite the fact that Josephine County enjoys the lowest property tax rates in Oregon, about a quarter of the state average.
People pretty much support law enforcement. They just aren't ready to pay for the law enforcement. And I think that's part of the difference. It's all about a choice.
So why is the county in such dire financial straits? Well, it has a lot to do with the timber industry, which used to be the backbone of the economy for this area.
On the slopes of the Cascade Range, the Northwest citizen is a lumberjack.
This is a government video from the 1940s.
Out of the dark of the forest, he cuts trees as high as skyscrapers and rolls them down the mountain to be made into homes and furniture and books to be read.
During the 60s and 70s, Oregon produced close to 9 billion board feet of wood each year, enough to frame more than 500,000 houses. It was a pretty good time to be a logger. It was also a good time to be a taxpayer. More than half of Oregon's acreage belongs to the federal government, and counties with lots of federal land got to collect a cut of the revenue from logging. So tax rates in some places became very low. But then something happened in 1994 that would change everything for the Northwest logging industry and Josephine County. Something designed to protect the region's natural resources. But it came at a big cost to the people that live there.
We are announcing a plan today which we believe will strengthen the long-term economic and environmental health of the Pacific Northwest and Northern California.
That's President Bill Clinton. He's introducing a set of guidelines to tighten environmental regulations in Oregon, Washington, and California.
We know that our solutions will not make everybody happy. Indeed, they may not make anybody happy.
They certainly didn't make the timber industry happy. In a report from 2011, a logging group blamed the Northwest Forest Plan for the closure of 261 mills and the loss of 50,000 jobs. There used to be more than a dozen mills in Josephine County, but the last one is closing this year. Mark Haggerty, an expert in rural economic policy, says a lot of small communities didn't know how to deal with this drop.
Because payments were so large through the 60s, 70s, and into the 1980s, local governments became dependent upon them, and they relied on them to fund basic services. It made it really difficult for them to go back and to try to diversify the economy where options were limited or to raise revenue from other sources.
Let me tell you exactly what was going on here. As the timber industry declined, county revenues, which were based on logging, declined too. So, the federal government stepped in to make up the difference with something called the Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act. Quite a mouthful. The act propped up counties across the U.S., doling out billions to more than 40 states, because very little timber harvesting was taking place. You might call these make-good payments, since it was the government's environmental rules that were causing problems. Some would even say welfare. The act was supposed to last for 6 years, enough time for communities to get back on their financial feet. But it kept getting extended, sometimes at the 11th hour. Finally, in 2012, a lot of the money dried up, and the Josephine County Sheriff's Department was walloped by the fallout. On a sunny Wednesday in May of 2012, 39 inmates pour out of the Josephine County Jail. Some sprint out, whooping and hollering.
I love you, man. I mean, I love you.
Keep out of trouble, brother.
Some look incredulously from side to side, like it's all too good to be true. They'd been charged with everything from drug possession to third-degree rape and robbery. But today, none of that mattered. The jail no longer had money to keep them. So, they were set free. A local newscaster from KDRV News catches up with this one guy named Will Smith.
Will Smith spent the last 20 days behind bars for fourth-degree assault and felony possession of drugs and a firearm. Wednesday, he got to sit under a tree and smoke a cigarette, not believing his luck.
He says he was surprised that he got out.
I would expect to be one of the ones that don't get out.
Why is that?
I've been a bad boy.
Letting the bad boys out of jail was the beginning of bigger problems in Josephine County. It became a surreal scene for the criminals and for the police trying to catch them.
If you can imagine a burglary being committed, arresting the person inside the residence, and then handcuffing them, locking them outside, and only being able to issue a citation because you can't lodge them in a jail with the way that the staffing levels are.
That's Bill Landis, the chief of police in Grants Pass, Josephine County's biggest city.
Additionally, with a stolen vehicle, pulling them over in a felony car stop with guns pointed after spiking the tires, maybe sometimes ending in a crash, taking the people out and arresting them, and issuing citations because the jail can't take those type of individuals due to the staffing levels. It starts to be almost like a crazy system when you start thinking about it that way.
Since 2012, the total number of crimes reported in rural Josephine has increased by about 50% each year. And the value of stolen or damaged property has gone from about $12,000 a year to about $300,000. The list of crimes is long, and it's growing. Burglaries, vandalisms, thefts, even murders. And without much law enforcement, residents in Josephine County are filling the gaps themselves. I'm at a sprawling outdoor gun range, attending a class put on by Rogue Protection Group. They're a local company that teaches everything from martial arts to handgun fundamentals.
I'm going to explain every single drill, everything we do before we do it. You'll see me do it or you'll see Jason do it first.
The instructor is a big guy named Kelly Sparlin. He's a Navy vet who's also trained with the Israelis and the Russians. He even did private security for a celebrity he won't name. In other words, somebody you'd want on your team. Today's lesson is about securing your property.
Because this is assuming I drive home and my door's wide open and I need to clear my house. So I'm not going to be like, it's not a quick draw kind of thing or a defensive situation.
Kelly lines everyone up and has them shoot at people-shaped cardboard targets. First standing, then kneeling, then lying down. They shoot at targets for most of the morning. During a break, I pull aside one of the people in the class, a muscular guy with wraparound sunglasses named Zach Scogley.
Can you talk about that need to protect yourself given the law enforcement situation here in Josephine County?
Law enforcement. In fact, I have a story about that.
Everybody does.
Yeah, so I live in the county.
Zach tells me about a time he caught someone videotaping his wife through the bathroom window. He had to wait an hour and a half for police to show up. He says it's up to residents to protect themselves.
I encourage really anybody I can to, at the very least, get a concealed weapons permit, because then they know how to be responsible with a weapon. They now have a reason to own a weapon.
In fact, in 1 year, the sheriff's department processed nearly twice as many concealed carry permits as the year before.
Go ahead and load my crate. Contact!
Trista Ely is one of Rogue Protection Group's owners. Back at her office, she says business is booming. She estimates that 80% of her customers are there because there's little help from law enforcement.
It is what it is. Now, we know that we don't have a sheriff's department that is going to be capable of taking care of our citizens, so they take care of themselves.
As Trista talks, my eyes wander over to a printout from the sheriff's office hanging on the wall. Instructions for how to report a crime. There are two options. Call a number and leave a message, which will be returned, quote, as time allows, or submit a report online. I try to imagine a burglar breaking into my house. I run into my room, lock the door behind me, then dash off an email. I look back toward Trista and notice her handbag now. There's a Glock pistol sitting right next to it. Sheriff Daniel is back in his squad car, heading north to the location of a crime he believes could have been prevented if his department was better staffed.
One of the most brutal murder scenes I've ever been to.
It happened last June at the home of Jerry and Joanne Jackson, an elderly couple who lived in a secluded neighborhood outside of town. A guy named Brian Killian allegedly broke into the Jackson's home, intending to rob it. Then he realized they were there. Daniel says this is what happened next.
Stabbed them both. Killed one of their dogs. Senseless. Maybe somebody that should have already been in our custody.
And in fact, he had already been in their custody. Just a few months before the Jacksons were murdered, Killian had been arrested for allegedly stealing a car. But after just 2 days, he was released because the county didn't have enough money to keep him in jail. It wasn't like it was his first run-in with the law. We ran a background check. Over the years, he's been arrested 6 times for charges ranging from drug possession to robbery, and spent about 5 years in prison. After the Jackson killings, he was arrested again and is now facing 23 charges, including aggravated murder. Daniel pulls up to the Jackson's house, a secluded spot at the top of a winding, tree-lined road.
Looks like somebody new bought it. Who would have thought, you know, the random act of violence would come to a nice, nice house, nice home, with the suspect not knowing them? You know, that's the scary part, is it can happen to anybody.
You might think a ghastly murder like that one would convince residents that they needed to fund the sheriff's department. But Daniel says that didn't happen.
Well, that time came and went without a blink of an eye. And another levy goes down. And, you know, the citizenry decides not to support law enforcement again.
In fact,
the latest attempt to raise taxes didn't even make the ballot. Politicians in Josephine County are running out of ideas. It's not that they're sitting on their hands. It's more that their hands are tied. For example, one county commissioner recently proposed declaring a public safety fiscal emergency, which could offer some financial relief with help from the state of Oregon. But, as usual, it's a tough sell for residents.
I don't think the answer is ever to tax people to get what you deem to be the proper way to govern.
This was a public meeting a few months ago. Residents got to weigh in on the emergency plan. Some were skeptical it would work, and very skeptical of state lawmakers telling them what to do.
If you are willing to give up our authority and let the state run the county, then you're obviously lacking in ability and talent to do the things we need you to do.
These people really don't want new taxes, even as their public safety crumbles. I didn't get it. I needed someone to break it down for me. So I asked Joseph Rice. He's a member of the Josephine County Oath Keepers, an organization dedicated to defending the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. He also recently lost a bid for a county commissioner seat. His take on everything? Crime stats are overblown. Josephine should be advertising its low taxes.
Let's give new business a 24-month personal property tax holiday. That way, when they move into the county, they set themselves up, they get their financial feet under them, and they get stable. They create long-term living wage jobs.
But what if they get robbed?
Well, when you say robbed, I went two places. Robbed on taxes or robbed by they broke into the business.
Sheriff Dave Daniel doesn't laugh about the issue much. He hopes the people he swore to protect can find a way to fund his department. But he is not optimistic.
For so long, we were just dependent on the almighty federal dollar. And I think it almost... I think it led to a feeling of entitlement, maybe.
Still, he won't give up.
We will not quit down to the last person when there's one penny left in the coffer. That last deputy will fight for the victims out there. Then there are many.
Our story was reported by Reveal's Byer Duggan. Coming up, a tiny town in Texas is left without a functioning government after nearly all of the town's officials were taken away in handcuffs by the FBI. That story when we come back on Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Hi, listeners. It's Julie B. Chan, the show's digital editor. You've been hearing about lawless places all across the globe. And if you follow Reveal on Instagram, you can meet some of the characters behind these stories. This week, we're taking you inside Josephine County, Oregon, where budget cuts have stretched law enforcement to the breaking point, and residents are stepping in to fill the gap. You won't want to miss these photo dispatches, including scenes from the self-defense trainings at Rogue Protection Group. Just fire up Instagram and follow us at Reveal News. Again, that's at Reveal News.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Edson. Crystal City is a quaint little town in South Texas with a population of about 7,500. Its most famous resident is a cartoon sailor with a corncob pipe, one good eye, and a fearsome right hook. Popeye is the official mascot of Crystal City, the spinach capital of the world. But the town is now known as one of the most corrupt little cities in America. This is that town's mayor getting arrested for inciting a riot at his own city council meeting.
You're not going to arrest me for what?
Only in Crystal City, ladies and gentlemen. This is injustice.
The mayor had stormed out of city council chambers and gotten into an altercation with several residents demanding his resignation. You see, they wanted him out because a couple weeks earlier, he had been arrested by the FBI in a raid that took down nearly the entire city council. They were accused of taking bribes in exchange for awarding city business. The life-size Popeye statue in front of City Hall had a front-row seat to the mayhem. But since he isn't talking, We sent Reveal's Ike Sriskandaraja to find out what's going on, and he joins me now. Hey, Ike.
Hey, Al.
Hey, man. So, now, I've heard about corruption in City Hall before, but this sounds like a whole new level. I mean, the most corrupt little city?
Yeah, when I heard about this place, it sounded kind of lawless, but when I got down there, I didn't expect to see the government dysfunction unfold right in front of me.
So what happened?
So I'm down at City Hall in Crystal City, hoping to interview people who work there, and I've got my mic out when I hear the door buzzer and two guys come rushing in. They look like they're on a mission, and I recognize one of them as he walks by.
This is the kind of problem we run into when we're trying to cover meeting.
So who's that?
That's the indicted mayor, Ricardo Lopez, and he's here to call an emergency meeting of the city council. He's looking a little crazed and slurring a little bit, but he promises me he only uses prescription drugs. So I follow him into City Hall.
Do you mind if I record any of this while we're talking?
Go ahead.
My name is Ricardo Lopez, and I'm still the mayor of Crystal City. And hold on, let me try to call the mayor.
He rushes off to flush out the city clerk. The emergency here for Mayor Lopez is that he doesn't know how much longer he'll be in power, and he still has a few things he wants to get done, including appointing an interim city manager, since the last one's on indefinite suspension. A few minutes later, he finds the clerk.
Do you know the requirements for the emergency?
Well, this situation with the interim city manager, it is an emergency. The city hall has to answer to somebody.
But the clerk doesn't think this is an emergency situation, so she won't grant the meeting. The mayor is clearly not welcome, but he still feels like he belongs here.
Did I clean up my city hall? And did I clean up corruption? Yeah. Am I indicted? Yeah. We're going to see in the court of law if I'm guilty or not.
He sounds a little agitated there.
And get this. After their encounter, the clerk calls the cops on the mayor. He gets arrested again. This time, he's charged with harassing the clerk. Now, this sort of craziness has almost become routine in Crystal City.
Okay, I'll let you take it from here, but how did things unravel, and who's running this place now?
Well, it's barely running. Next door to City Hall are the city council chambers, and I get permission to go inside. The large city seal with the winking Popeye hangs on the front wall. Two mismatched tables are pulled together in an L shape, and they are scattered with engraved nameplates that feel like tombstones. Now, to find out how the chambers became this political graveyard, I decided to meet with one of the town's elder statesmen, former Mayor Jose Mata.
Mr. Jose Mata.
Jose Mata, nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Jose Mata was mayor back in the 80s, and he and a group of friends have been keeping a close eye on City Hall over the past few years.
We just call ourselves the Four C's, Concerned Citizens of Crystal City.
Four C's. It sounds like a doo-wop group.
They're a group of seniors, some former mayors and council members. They drink Pepsi, eat chips, and tell me where they think this town went wrong. It all started in the city council chambers.
Please raise your right hand. I, and each state your name.
This is video of the council meeting taken by the Zavala County Sentinel in 2014. That's Mayor Lopez and two new, fresh-faced young council members taking the oath.
The duties of the office.
The duties of the office.
Of mayor or councilman one and two.
Mayor
or councilman. Sorry.
On the video, you can see they're a little nervous and excited, like it's the first day of school. But within a few months, things unravel when the new council members start deferring to city attorney James Jonas. Here he is walking the mayor through his first public hearing.
Tonight, Mayor Lopez is here to gather information in this first hearing. It's really a one-way conversation. As his city attorney, I urge him to not go into a dialogue back and forth with you.
Jonas stood out in the overwhelmingly Hispanic population, an Anglo outsider who had been an influential Republican lobbyist in D.C. After the Democrats took over Congress and the White House in 2008, he fell on hard times, even spending a few months in jail for not paying his child support. Then came a lifeline from Crystal City. A former client of his was a councilman there and offered him the job of city attorney in 2012. He didn't even have to apply. Longtime political observer Jose Mata watched with disgust.
It was a Republican leader that came and poisoned Crystal City to the ground.
Jonas convinced the new city council members to hire him as the city manager. And since he was already the attorney, Jonas got to write his own contract.
No other city manager, city attorney in the history of Crystal City that had been paid the salary that was paid and awarded to city manager James Jonas III.
In a town where the median household income is $26,000, Jonas paid himself $216,000 plus a $6,000 travel stipend. That's nearly half the annual municipal budget. At the same time, the council is voting to raise taxes and hike fees. By the end of last year, the council meetings are standing room only. Angry citizens are filling the doorway as Jose Mata steps forward to challenge what the new mayor and his city council are doing.
This is why this gathering is here, because now you've got yourselves in a corner where you have to raise everything in order to pay this man.
That's right. Yes.
Residents have a laundry list of allegations. Unjustified firings of city employees, questionable bids being awarded to family members, grant money disappearing without contractors getting paid. But what really seems to insult people is how blatant city manager Jonas was. He'd even established residency by claiming to live in a city landmark, an abandoned caboose in the middle of town. A local reporter from San Antonio News 4 confronted him about it on camera.
Did you really plan to live in the caboose on city property?
I absolutely hoped that that was a possibility.
That's when things went off the rails. Now, during my visit, I walked up to Jonas's supposed residence, a single train car planted on a cement slab about the size of a trailer home. It's painted with graffiti and the ground is covered in trash.
I recognize that caboose. It's so crazy that, I mean, I can see through it.
People were absolutely fed up here. And Jose Mata says they couldn't find anyone to help.
We started reaching out, you know, people that are in state level, district level, county level, city level, and we couldn't get anybody to hear us. And we wanted to put an end to it. Finally, some people here had been talking with the FBI. They were the ones that ultimately got the ball rolling.
Actually, it was more like a wrecking ball. Early one February morning, dozens of FBI agents stormed this little city hall, and the news media followed.
The feds say this is one of the most prolific cases of public corruption they've ever seen.
They arrested the whole city government. The FBI arresting the entire city government all at once.
The federal charges describe a scheme where Jonas offered to award building permits and construction contracts in exchange for money for himself and the council. And we're not talking about huge sums of money, a few thousand dollars for himself, a couple thousand for the council members. And at one point, the indictments allege he even got a contractor to pay for his country club membership. People in town had suspected as much for years, and they were thrilled to see federal agents finally kick down the doors of City Hall.
I think the reaction in Crystal City was that of joy.
That's Chris Combs, the special agent in charge of the FBI San Antonio division. And joy is not the typical reaction his agents get during a raid.
There were literally people coming up to us and thanking us for coming in and making those arrests.
Actually, everyone I talked with in Crystal City had something nice to say about the Federal Bureau of Investigation, including Mayor Lopez, who, despite his federal charges, still has praise for them.
There's hundreds of little cities suffering from this type of corruption. For the first time, the FBI is starting to do their job and sweeping this corruption in South Texas.
Public corruption is a top criminal priority for the FBI, with arrests tripling in recent years in this district. There were 64 cases in 2014. That's more than one a week. And just a few weeks ago, two public officials, a magistrate and a commissioner in the next county over, got sentenced in their own bribery scheme. Here's the FBI's Chris Combs again.
I think when you look at the rural nature of especially southern Texas, when you look at some of the poverty issues in small towns, that breeds corruption. And that's where we're looking a lot of our efforts towards.
In places like Crystal City, even a small amount of corruption can have a big impact.
Especially in a smaller town where there really isn't a large municipal budget. If pieces of that budget are going to corruption, that's taking a service away from those citizens. And I think people need to see that, that it's not a victimless crime.
Not long after the FBI raid, the citizens here fell victim to another municipal mess. A simple maintenance mistake at the town's water tower contaminated their water supply.
Now some residents' water is running black.
Anarchy and a bathtub full of black water.
The reason that happened, they didn't properly close a valve.
That's Lara Lopez. She runs the Chamber of Commerce.
Why? Due to lack of oversight and supervision on the part of the administration. Because by that time, all this other stuff was going on.
The water turning black was a metaphor for all that's going wrong in this town. She says it's been really bad for business.
What kind of incentive am I going to put out there for anybody from the Chamber of Commerce saying, hey, new business, come to Crystal City? And I mean, if you're a business, really? Who's going to touch us a 10-foot pole?
Its reputation also hurts the town's ability to go after federal and state grants. And even if all the alleged perpetrators disappear, the stain of corruption doesn't just wash away.
The 3-year term that these people served, the legacy that they left and the mess, it's going to take a whole lot longer to clean up.
I wanted to know what it takes to clean up corruption in a town like this. So I found somebody who's been trying to do just that for 30 years. United States Attorney for the Western District of Texas, Richard Durbin. No relation to the Illinois senator. He's philosophical about what makes human beings so corruptible.
You know, at some level, and I mean, this is, and we're way off of where my expertise is. But, you know, at some level, we're all sort of tribal.
All our lives, we act in the interest of our family, our community. But one day, when given the power of a public office, we're expected to put our own relationships second.
Without having a lot of experience and training in that area, it's probably very difficult for people to recognize that I've got a conflict. And then once you've recognized the conflict, what do you do about it?
He says many people don't know what to do about it, especially when an alleged corrupting influence, someone like City Attorney James Jonas, takes control.
Once they're in charge, once they've got that upper hand and that control, it's very difficult to get the control back. It's very difficult to get the integrity back.
I talked with the indicted mayor, Ricardo Lopez, about how corruption takes root. Even though he's been arrested several times and is facing bribery charges, he says he got into public service for the right reason. He told me he saw the city as a patient needing the help of a doctor. Now, he's not a doctor. He sells cars on Craigslist for a living. But for some reason, he thought he could help.
That's when I decided to run. It was in surgery. Seeing a human heart laid on the table and still beating. How hard can it be to try to help the city?
Well, heart surgery is really hard.
Well, it's a lot of stress.
And not just stress, but you got to, you know, be
well,
a surgeon.
The same way. You just got to not give up.
Now, Lopez didn't go to medical school, but his patient is still on life support. In a landslide recall election this spring, all indicted council members were removed. Only 25 people voted for the mayor to stay in office. Jose Mata tells me he and the other concerned citizens will continue to watch over elected officials in Crystal City. It's like watching a train wreck. How can you look away?
I believe that it had not been for the absurdity of the council, we probably wouldn't have been able to get him out. Because that's what made the citizens of Crystal City get all riled up.
So the absurdity actually helps.
Yes, yes. It was their doing that made our citizens, our community, realize that we were headed in the wrong direction. And we all finally came together.
Which is probably the best advice for confronting corruption.
Our story was produced and reported by Ike Sriskandaraja, with additional reporting from Andy Becker. Mayor Lopez, the indicted city council members, and city manager James Jonas will face trial this summer. We reached out to Jonas for comment, but he did not respond.
And don't forget, folks, when you goes to the polls today, a vote for Popeye means 2 cans of spinach for every pot.
You're listening to Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Hey there. I'm Emmanuel Martinez, a data reporter at Reveal.
This hour, we've been exploring what happens when systems that are designed to keep order fall apart. Sometimes that means a breakdown in government and law enforcement. Other times, it's more of an everyday occurrence. We want to hear about the places in your life where there are no rules. It could be a mosh pit at a punk show, an amateur hockey game with no referee, or a place in the middle of nowhere where no one is looking. We want to hear about your lawless lands. So the next time you're confronting chaos, record a voice memo with your name and a brief description of where you are. Send it to lawless@cironline.org, and we may use it in a future episode or on our website. Again, that's lawless@cironline.org.
From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX, this is Reveal. I'm Al Letson. Today we've been looking at lawless lands. What happens in the absence of government? Who or what comes in to fill the void? Sometimes it's a strong man enforcing his will, other times it's just anarchy. And occasionally, it's something completely unexpected. In December 2013, Jeremiah Heaton's daughter asked him a simple question.
We were in a room and I was playing and she kind of went into a quiet moment and she looked at me and asked, you know, will I ever be a real princess one day? And I guess the nature of the way that she presented the question to me made me realize that she was somewhat serious about it. And I answered her that, you know, absolutely she would be.
I think most people would find a way to deflect that answer, maybe tell their daughter she's always been a princess in their heart, but not Jeremiah.
You know, I had in that moment made a statement to my daughter that, you know, I couldn't really honor, and that bothered me. Because I didn't want to be a parent that told their child something that they could not follow through with. And that began the trying to answer the question, is this even possible anymore?
The answer is maybe, kinda. Jeremiah got on the internet and found something that just might work. Bir Tawil. It's a swath of desert wedged between Sudan and southern Egypt. It's the last unclaimed territory on Earth, a true terra nullius, Latin for no man's land. Been that way for more than 100 years, when England drew some lines in the sand to separate countries. There ended up being a dispute over competing maps and a neighboring stretch of desert, and in the end, Bir Tawil remained unclaimed. So when Jeremiah discovered this, he got an Egyptian visa, packed his bags, and set off. Now, this is not an easy place to get to.
I had never traveled to that part of the world, and so I traveled to Cairo, and from there went to Hurghada and traveled along the coast to the village of Shalatin, and from there trekked towards the southwest, towards the Bir Tawil region.
After a brutal journey, which took days, planes, trains, and automobiles, Jeremiah laid his eyes on his new kingdom, 800 square miles of relentless wind, sand, and punishing sun.
In the period of time from researching this up till the point that I went, my children had designed a flag for the kingdom, and so I had a flag manufactured and took that to Bir Tawil, and then actually on Emily's 7th birthday, I planted the flag. And when I returned to the area where I ultimately was staying and had internet access, I made one Facebook post about what I had done for Emily in terms of creating a new country so that she could be a real princess. And that's where things went somewhat beyond what my expectations were.
His post included a photo of him standing on a cluster of rocks in the middle of the desert. The flag of his new nation flies directly behind him, the Kingdom of North Sudan. Later, he wrote a proclamation of independence.
For countless millennia, our planet has witnessed the rise and fall of peaceful societies and those of cruel heartlessness, with a thousand shades in between.
And the news media took notice.
And I began being contacted by news outlets around the world about what I had done. And it was only 3 days after that that, you know, the CNN satellite truck was parked in my front yard, which was, you know, surreal. The speed at which news moves today when there's a story that interests people, it really is amazing. I think over the period of a month, I conducted anywhere from 300 to 400 interviews with outlets in every major country around the world.
Disney even bought the film rights. And all of a sudden, Bir Tawil became the main focus of Jeremiah's life. He was serious about following through on his claim, so he started having conversations with investors and developing ideas about what he would do with his kingdom.
I want to use the Bir Tawil region in the Kingdom of North Sudan to be that laboratory for agricultural science. What we're focusing on is a new type of agriculture called controlled environment agriculture, also known as vertical farming. And the Japanese have really mastered the techniques of growing lettuce indoors. And so, you know, why Bir Tawil? Well, it represents the most extreme conditions that exist on Earth. And if we can grow food there using a minimal amount of water, using these controlled environments in Bir Tawil, then that will allow us to expand that to other areas. And so what we're focused on in terms of our agricultural research is the use of water. If we don't start taking steps now to combat the food security issues that face our planet, then we're going to be in a very tough situation here in 30 years.
While Jeremiah was dreaming big about his new nation, other people were feeling that the Kingdom of North Sudan was crossing into some pretty sensitive territory. Many bloggers, tweeters, and commentators began condemning Jeremiah, namely because he's a white man claiming a part of Africa, which is something the world has seen before.
I really was surprised by it. I grew up in Northeast Georgia in an area that was very diverse. I never ever seen anything through any type of racial lens. And so being attacked as someone who didn't belong in this area simply because the color of my skin was white was very much a surprise to me. And, you know, I think it's unfortunate on many levels that people look at me and see me in some sort of a racial way. And, you know, I have no more control over the color of my skin than does anyone else on Earth.
No, I don't expect you to. I totally don't expect you to. I totally get what you're saying. And I would just say respectfully, like, you know, you get to live in that world where you can not deal with the racial component of stuff. I'm a black man that was raised in the South, and I didn't get that opportunity. Like, I had to always deal with the racial component of stuff. And in my daily life, like, I'm not going around looking for racists hiding in the closets or anything like that. But because of the skin that I'm in and the skin that you're in, like, the way that we connect with the world are different, just fundamentally different.
Sure.
And so, you know, I don't think that you went in there with the intentions of being, quote-unquote, the white savior. But I do think that to think about the actions that you've taken without looking at it in the context of history, it, you know, is problematic.
Sure. And that's something that once it was brought to my attention, that was a concern for people. And I've worked my hardest to try to explain what the intention is. And I think one of the variables that is different in my particular case versus, you know, what happened during British colonialism or, you know, some of the religious activities that have occurred in Africa is that where this land has no population, you know, we, in effect, can carry out these activities and not have any impact on any sort of local population because no one lives there.
Jeremiah believes that no one lives in Bir Tawil. We looked into it, and it turns out there's a nomadic tribe that's roamed the Sahara, including Bir Tawil, for centuries. They're called the Ababda, and they still pass through the region today. They're not permanent residents in the technical sense, but they're around. And we track one of them down with help from a Sudanese journalist named Idris Babiker, who translated for us.
The area means a lot for me. I feel part of me there. My root is there, and I'm nothing without Bir Tawil.
Hassan Alabadi is a local leader of his tribe. He was near Sudan's border with Bir Tawil when we spoke by phone, and he takes issue with Jeremiah.
Yes, we have heard about the American who proclaimed his kingdom there, but he left before we could reach him. We wanted to tell him that the area belongs to us. The Ababda, our ancestor graves, are still there, and we have come from there too. If we meet him, we would tell him that we would not let him or anybody else on Bir Tawil, and we will not allow him to have this land.
There's a big question as to whether or not Jeremiah can legally claim this piece of land. According to international law, it's possible, but first he must obtain recognition from other countries, namely his neighbors, Egypt and Sudan. We got in touch with the Egyptian and Sudanese embassies, who are both aware of Jeremiah's claim. They wouldn't go on record with a statement about the Kingdom of North Sudan, But the vibe they gave us was that Jeremiah will probably have to wait a long time before he ever gets their stamp of approval. Before we go, we want to take you to one last lawless place. I know it doesn't sound very lawless. These kids are having a great time. They could be on a jungle gym in your neighborhood, right? But these kids are in no playground. Independent radio producer and friend of the show, Anna Adlerstein, explains where she found them.
On this island in Greece where about 1,000 to 1,100 refugees are being housed in a facility constructed for 300.
These kids have lost their homes, and some of them have even lost friends and loved ones to wars they left behind in Syria, Afghanistan, and other countries. But today, in the dust and chaos of this overcrowded refugee camp, about 30 of them hop on a slide they've made and glide to the bottom. Unmitigated joy.
The thing is constructed on a hill, and there's like this big concrete ramp that leads from level to level. And the kids had a big metal door and were sliding down it as a means of entertainment. And I think that's pretty damn lawless.
And when you think about it, that's pretty damn inspiring. For more on what you just heard, plus our latest stories, go to revealednews.org. Thanks for listening. Our show was edited by Taki Telenitas, and Ike Sriskandaraja was our lead producer. Special thanks to Jim Malowitz, CB Lopez, Reveal's Andy Becker, Liam Moriarty, Jack Shanker, and Anna Adlerstein. Our sound design team is the Wonder Twins, my man, Jay Breezy, Mr. Jim Briggs, and Claire C. Note Mullen. Amy Pyle is our editor-in-chief, and Krista Scharfenberg is our head of studio. Suzanne Reber is our executive editor, and our executive producer is Kevin Sullivan. Our theme music is by Camerado, Lightning. Support for Reveal is provided by the Reva and David Logan Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation. Reveal is a co-production of the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. I'm Al Letson, and remember, there is always more to the story.